The following message is from Pastor Steve Lee of Emmanuel Community Church. More information about the ministry of Emmanuel Community Church can be found at emmanuelcommunity.org.
Thanks to everyone who's already shared for this first service here in our new building. My name's Steve. I'm one of the pastors here. And as I was helping here yesterday to get the sanctuary ready for the service, I was just struck by all the different places that we've worshiped as a church over the years, whether it was a school gym or a cafeteria or other people's churches that we've rented. And finally, we are worshiping in a space of our own. And as a church family, this is going to be the place where we are really going to settle down and make it a home, a place that I think God has provided for us, where we're going to be able to gather and grow for many years to come. And I'm so thankful for everyone who has pitched in over these many months to really get us ready for this day and make this a reality for our church. It's been years of searching and planning and praying and lots of work days and fundraising efforts. And now we are finally here in our new sanctuary. And it is now God's invitation to us, I think, to make this house a home. And home is something that we build together. We do it by sharing our lives with one another. And our hope is that everyone who will walk through these doors here at this church will encounter genuine community, will experience what it means to be truly known and genuinely belong. And we've been walking through the Gospel of John for about a year now, and the timing has just worked out wonderfully so that we were able to get to the crucifixion of Jesus on Good Friday and then the resurrection on Easter. But it's interesting that for today, this first service in our new sanctuary, we come to John 21. And it's a passage that I think is so fitting for this occasion because it is about what it takes to create a place for broken people who are actually welcomed home. And at the end of John 20, Thomas makes this amazing confession after seeing the risen Jesus. And he says, "My Lord and my God." And then John wraps everything up with this really powerful statement in verses 30 to 31, where he says, "Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name." Now, I don't know about you, but that sounds like an ending to me, right? But it's interesting that that's not how the gospel ends, because there's actually a whole other chapter after these words. And I think it's because there is this really big loose end still dangling in John's gospel. And that loose end is named Peter. Before I get into Peter's story, though, let me share another story here about just what happened literally a few days ago. I tend to pride myself on being very deliberate and careful in what I do. Someone who doesn't make too many embarrassing mistakes. And then on Friday, I sent out this email that was supposed to go only to those who were selected for our 2026 Mexico mission team, letting them know that they're on the team and congratulating them. But instead, it went out to the entire ICC mailing list. 966 recipients got this email. Well, almost everyone, except the Mexico team, okay? They were the only ones that didn't get this email. And to make matters worse, the truth is it was kind of a sensitive message because we had to actually turn away quite a few applicants. And suddenly, these applicants were receiving this confusing email congratulating them that they were on the team. And when I realized what I had done, I didn't hear a rooster crow, but I heard Carol screaming. Followed by really loud laughter. And I'm not even going to get into even how many emails I received from you guys telling me about the mistake I made. And so thank all of you. Thank the many, many of you who emailed me and said, I don't think I was supposed to get this email. Have you ever failed so publicly like that before? And I wonder, how do you handle it? I think Peter experienced something like that, a failure that was so visible, so devastating, that he wasn't sure how he was going to move forward after it and recover. His denial of Jesus is, interestingly, one of the stories that shows up in every one of the Gospels. It was like every one of the Gospel writers says, this is so important that we have to include it in the story of Jesus. And so we get to John 21, and it begins like this. Afterward, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Galilee. It happened this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, also known as Didymus, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two other disciples were together. I'm going out to fish, Simon Peter told them. And they said, we'll go with you. So they went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. And so after Jesus appeared twice to the disciples in Jerusalem, he instructs them to go ahead and wait for him in Galilee, where he will meet them. And having arrived in Galilee, Peter decides something interesting. He decides to go fishing. And the six other disciples that are with him say they're going to join him. And so some have gone as far as characterizing what Peter did that day as apostasy. Basically a denial of his faith, because he was supposed to have left his fishing boats to follow Jesus. I think that is going too far, but what we can say is that the picture that we have of Peter in John 21 is very different than the triumphant, joyful, self-assured, spirit-filled person that we see in the book of Acts. He's somewhere in between these two stories. And Peter's denial was about as catastrophic a personal failure as I think anyone could experience or imagine. And I think for him, the easiest thing in that moment to do what he knew how to do well, and it was fishing. But that night, they catch absolutely nothing. And then at first light, this figure appears on the shore that they cannot recognize and asks them, friends, have you caught any fish? And they respond that they haven't, and that they've. And then comes this instruction that would have sounded completely absurd to any experienced fisherman. Throw your net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some. If you're an experienced fisherman, if you've ever gone with someone who doesn't fish, have you ever had that experience? Go throw, cast it over there, you know? It's just ridiculous that just because I cast the net on the other side of the boat, I'm going to catch something. And these men would have known these waters like the back of their hand. And the stranger on this beach tells them that the problem is you just got to go on the other side of the boat and throw your net. But it's interesting that they listen regardless of how absurd it is. And they cast the net and they catch so many fish that it practically breaks their net. And in verse 7 of John 21, it says, then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, it is the Lord. As soon as Simon Peter heard him say, it is the Lord, he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he had taken it off and jumped into the water. So John is the one that makes the connection that it is Jesus, but it is Peter who throws himself into the water to get to the shore first. In verse 9, it says, when they landed, they saw a fire of burning coals there with fish on it and some bread. Peter and the others find that Jesus has already made a charcoal fire and is cooking breakfast for them. Now, that Greek word that John uses is actually a kind of an unusual one. It is a very specific word for fire, and it is only used twice in his gospel. It's used in this verse, and the other time, interestingly, that he uses it is in John 18:18, where it says, it was cold, and the servants and officials stood around a fire they had made to keep warm. Peter also was standing with them, warming himself. As you can guess, this was the night of Jesus' arrest and his trial. And they're sitting around this fire when three times Peter is asked if he is associated with Jesus, and three times he denies it. And so as Peter reaches the shore in Galilee and approaches this charcoal fire, and John happens to use the exact identical words to describe the fire, I think the message is that every nerve in Peter's body must have remembered the last time he smelled that smell and experienced a campfire like that. And I don't think that is cruelty on the part of Jesus, but it is a necessary part of his restoration. It was like when Jesus asked the woman at the well in John 4, go get your husband, right? Jesus leads Peter squarely to confront his brokenness and his failure in order to heal that open wound. But before they get to that difficult business, Jesus feeds them all breakfast. And then when the meal is finished, Jesus turns to Peter and asks him, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? In other words, do you still think that you are more than these? Do you think that you still love me more than these others do? Can you turn this off? Because I should be on the headset, right? I don't know if this is interfering, but okay. All right. This is exactly what Peter claimed at the Last Supper, isn't it? All the others would fall away, and that he never would. And Peter's failure had been witnessed by the other disciples. And as uncomfortable as it may have been, his restoration needed to be public and in the presence of those other disciples, because his failure was also seen by them. And Peter responds with humility of someone who knows that he's failed. Yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he offers no evidence for his love anymore, but all he does is rely on the knowledge of Jesus. And again, Jesus says, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And again, Peter replies, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And a third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And we're told by this third time, Peter is deeply hurt. Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Three times, Peter has denied Jesus. And now Jesus gives him three opportunities to undo that denial and to affirm his love. And after each one of those, it's interesting that Jesus tells him, feed my lambs, take care of my sheep, feed my sheep. In other words, Jesus is not just merely restoring a broken relationship with Peter, but he is recalling him into his ministry to be a leader of his movement. And so for Jesus, what I think we learn from this story is that our failures are not the end of our story. Those places of deepest failure are, in fact, often where Jesus meets us most personally, restoring us and entrusting us to his work yet again. What's interesting is that at some point in this conversation, it seems that Peter and Jesus start walking away from the other disciples. And maybe they're just taking a walk along the beach, along the shoreline. And during that conversation, Jesus tells Peter about his future. In verses 18 to 19, very truly, I tell you, when you were young, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hand and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go. Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said to him, follow me. Now this is Jesus essentially telling Peter that one day he was going to be given the ultimate opportunity to be a faithful witness, basically by becoming a martyr, by being crucified. And listen, I'm not sure how you would respond if you heard news like that about your future, about how you are going to die. But Peter's response is strange, to say the least. In verses 20 to 21, Peter turned and saw that the disciple whom Jesus loved was following them. This was the one who had leaned back against Jesus at the supper and had said, Lord, who is going to betray you? When Peter saw him, he asked, Lord, what about him? Now, to understand the weight of this question, you have to understand the relationship between Peter and John. These two men were arguably the most central figures in the story of Jesus, and they were almost comically different from one another. Peter is impulsive and bold, prone to acting before he thinks, but also clearly the leader of the group. John is contemplative, thoughtful. He is often the first to grasp spiritual truths and seems to have a particularly close and intimate relationship with Jesus. He is, in fact, the one who leans on Jesus' chest at the Last Supper. He is the one that stands at the foot of the cross when all the others deserted him. And the truth is, when you actually read the Gospels very carefully, there seems to be almost some type of a friendly rivalry between the two of them. John is the one who is seated next to Jesus at the Last Supper, where Peter is seated far enough that he has to kind of shout to John to ask him to ask Jesus a question. We're told that both of them were racing to the tomb, as we saw on Easter Sunday. And John, who wrote the book, goes out of his way to point that he got there first. And not only that, but after they got to the tomb and witnessed the empty tomb, he notes that I was the one that believed. Doesn't say anything about Peter's faith. And now here at the Sea of Galilee, Jesus and Peter take a private walk, and Peter turns around, and John is following them. It's a little weird, isn't it, right? John is just saying, I just want to tag along and see what you guys are talking about. And so it's that setting in which Peter turns around, and he cannot resist the comparison and go, what about John, you know? What's going to happen in his future? Peter has just been told he's going to die a martyr's death, that his faithfulness is going to cost him everything, his life. And in response to that sobering news, his reaction is to wonder what's going to happen to John. Is he going to get off any easier than me? And if we're honest, I think we can all relate to Peter, can't we? We also take notice when someone else's path in life seems different than ours. And we wonder if the deal that we're getting from God is fair, don't we? Jesus refuses to answer Peter's question, though, of comparison with each other. In verse 22, Jesus answered, "If I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? You must follow me." In other words, Jesus tells Peter, John's story is mine to write, just like your story. Your only job is to follow me. Both of them belong to Jesus, and there is a place for both of their unique journeys in Jesus' story. And the truth is, I think I can identify with John's personality a lot more than I can identify with Peter's. And I'll even go a step further that if I was one of those disciples at that time, I think the truth is Peter would have driven me crazy, you know? I think I would have been judging him all the time. But it's encouraging to know that Jesus chose people who are so completely different from one another to be part of his story. When we compare our stories to others, it is always tempting to ask, well, what about them? What about the person who doesn't seem to carry the same weight of failures that I do? What about those whose gifts seem so much more visible than mine, whose calling seems so much more important? What about the ones who seem favored by God and don't go through the kind of trials that I have to endure? I think to make this house a home is to realize that God has a place for all of us. I think it is so important for us to realize that we are all on different journeys and have different callings. But Peter's story reminds us how God brings us all together into one story that God is writing. I think we have to be reminded through the story that even though we have different temperaments and giftings and callings, there is a place for each one of us in the story of Jesus. And that must shape how we treat one another. If Jesus welcomes different people like Peter and John, then we are called to extend that same welcome with one another. As many of you heard through the testimonies, through the prayers that were offered today, this is a house that God has gifted us, and it is an awesome gift. But at the end of the day, for this to become a home, we must grow into the calling that we have to be the family of God that God wills us to be.